And then we have the same thing going on with student loans. Let me get my notes on the student loans, which is almost as scary as car loans. Your student loans, which is now another $1 trillion since the government took it over. You know, there are no more private student lenders. It's all government now because they're here to help you, and they can do such a better job than the private sector. Okay, so students have borrowed $1 trillion for college. $1 trillion, folks. This is just in the last few years. Most of the loans, and I find this really interesting, most of the loans were for online education courses. In 2000, that's just 15 years ago, right? The largest debt-funded college in the entire United States was New York University. You know, New York University is very credible. It's a long-standing, very old institution, great academic record, all sorts of laurels, you name it. That was just 15 years ago. NYU students had $2.2 billion in student loans outstanding back then. And they were the largest, facilitator of student loans. That's $2.2 billion with a B. Now, the leading debt-funded college in the United States is the University of Phoenix, online education. $36 billion in student debt associated with just the University of Phoenix. Wow. In fact, 8 out of the 10 largest debt-funded universities, i.e. the majority of their students borrow money to attend the university, are now online. And we all know, and the rate of default on student loans has been skyrocketing. The cost of student loans have been skyrocketing. The cost of tuition, because all these colleges know that the government is basically backing the student loan industry, have jacked their tuition. So the loans are much larger in addition to being more expensive. And we have another train off the tracks. Which brings us to the energy industry. $5 trillion in financing to energy firms. And all of that financing, all of it, was predicated on $60 to $110 barrel oil. Now, if you follow the oil markets at all, you know oil got down to a low of $26 a barrel. And has recently risen, in the last 3 weeks, and I think it closed yesterday in the $40 range. I think Thursday it closed at $40.17 a barrel. Now, that doesn't mean it's not going to go up, down, or whatever. All I'm saying is oil remains way below the BEP, the break-even point, for these debt-saddled energy companies. $5 trillion in debt. $5 trillion. So auto loans, subprime auto loans, which are in huge heap of trouble, and student loans, which are in a huge heap of trouble, and energy loans, which are in a huge heap of trouble. By the way, most of these loans mature between 2016 and the end of 2017. But what are they going to do? What are these companies going to do? So we got $7 trillion in debt out there that is in trouble. $7 trillion. That is more, folks, to put it in perspective, than the entire calamity with the housing market in 2008. And it doesn't even include housing, which is headed toward its own secondary repeated wreck. Now, we all know what happened in 2008. So I think we can make some fair assumptions, connect the dots, and know roughly what will happen when all these trains who have plunged off the tracks finally reach the cold, chilly waters at the bottom of the chasm over which the trestle had been transporting them, right? I think we know what's going to happen. You know, Japan, this is the third largest economy in the world, folks. This is not, as I was saying at the beginning of the show, this ain't Greece, this ain't Crete, this isn't Moldova, this isn't Baklavia, this isn't, you know, Timbuktu, this is Japan. They've been struggling for 20 years with financial malaise. Their debt is now 240%, that's 240% of their GDP. Our debt is about 105% of our GDP. By the way, that's doubled since Barry took office. We were at about 50% when he took office, give or take, maybe a little bit less. But Japan hit this wall a long time ago. And I've done a lot of shows on Greece. You can type in the search bar, Greece is California. And I went into a pretty good discussion of what ratios of debt to GDP start tipping a country over. Most economists agree it's like 130, 135%. But that anything over 100% is really dangerous. Anything approaching 100% is bad. In fact, anything over 50% is not good. So Japan, about 10 years ago, is where we are today. And they have tried every fiscal stimulus, every financial shenanigan you can imagine. And they now have negative interest rates. I've been talking about that. Some economists forecast that for the United States. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to hit her or not. But the bottom line with negative interest rates is the bank pays you to borrow and you pay the bank to have a savings account. That's how upside down that world is. And that's where Japan is at. Not only that, they're kind of doubling down on it. You can't buy Japanese bonds anymore because they're all bought by the central bank. And the yen, their currency, is printed to finance the purchase of the debt. Gee, kind of sounds like the Federal Reserve, doesn't it? I mean, it's a world gone mad. But one of the things that's happened over there, because of them hitting the wall on this debt, is, and excuse me, I was off, 240%, not 230, 240% of GDP. Japan's 30-year fiscal record, and remember, we're about 10 years into ours, their 30-year fiscal record has been 30 years of red ink, hemorrhaging profitability. Not that governments are profitable. Hemorrhaging money. Last year, Japan, this is after increasing their consumption tax, that basically is tax on everything, to 8% from 5%, they're still headed into fiscal oblivion. They spent $100 trillion last year. I'm sorry, 100 trillion yen last year. And they took in 50 trillion yen in revenue, which last time I checked is a 50 trillion yen deficit. That gets piled onto the public debt. I mean, it's kind of like just like we're doing here, but on so far a lesser scale. Anyway, To keep their bonds down, the central bank is printing and buying all the bonds. It's unbelievable. And on top of that, they kind of got the same demographic curve that we do. You know, our baby boomers, you know, the baby boom crowd are all reaching retirement. Millions and millions of people. Hence the big drain on Social Security and pension funds and, you know, all the stuff we've talked about. I mean, the money isn't there to pay everybody. Not in Social Security, that's why they just cut it in the dead of night. Not in pensions, which have been earning lousy returns. You know, when you have 0.25% prime rate and you're getting 0.5%, maybe, if you're lucky, in savings, at least it's not negative. And your pension fund that you have banked on to retire with was predicated on 7 to 8% returns, is only getting 0.5%. They're going to run out of money, aren't they? It's just math. 2 plus 2 is 4. Water runs downhill. I know I'm just a poor old hayseed Wyoming rancher, but I can figure this out. And so can you. That's why they don't tell you about it. They don't want you to figure it out. So Japan has kind of the same demographic curve going. Their population, now this is not, you know, we have not suffered this, has declined 30% to 90 million. Its working age population has plummeted from 78 million to 52 million, which is a 33% drop, by the way. Its labor force participation rate has been going down. And it only has 31 million workers. Unfortunately, Japan now has 31 million retirees. And that's going to be at 36 million by the year 2060. So you have a declining overall population. You have a declining workforce. You have a declining number of jobs. You have increasing debt and the carry on that debt. And you have more and more and more retirees drawing on the public funds, the pensions, the, I don't know what their equivalent of Social Security is over there, but, you know, whatever social program they have for their elderly. And you can see what a dead end this is. It's a rather horrific dead end. And just as Europe should be a lesson to us in social experimentation and Muslim immigration, particularly Islamic, radical Muslim immigration, civilizational jihad, as I discussed last week in my show, in discussing the white papers of the Muslim Brotherhood. Listen to that show if you didn't listen to it. It's pretty damn good. Or should I say, it'll give you a pretty good idea of what's going on there. Just as we have ignored the social lessons from Europe, so too are we ignoring the fiscal lessons from Japan. And by the way, Europe isn't very far behind Japan. We could get our fiscal lessons there too. But we're just ignoring them. And you know, you can't ignore reality. Eventually it will catch up to you. So, some things for you to think about. And this was prompted, this stuff. I got several emails this week. Most of them were on last week's show, but several of them kind of dug back into some other shows. And they were talking about how the market's not going down anymore, and it's up 13%, and it's only 2% off where it started the year. And, you know, what was I talking about? Blah, 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 blah. Well, if you want to go pour all your money into stocks, if you think all these companies are going to do great, if you think their profits are going to rise through the sky, if you think this debt problem doesn't exist, be my guest. Not my money. All I can do is bring you facts, folks. You got to make up your own minds. But I wanted to give you this slice of heaven this slice of debt heaven using just autos, just energy, and just student loans, and showing you that the total is more than the problem that we had with finance with subprime mortgage loans just 6 years ago, which I think you kind of remember what happened. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, what is the end result? What's going to happen? Because in the end, keeping yourselves safe and secure is physically, and I'm talking about your families too, is physically and financially. Otherwise, you're not here to rebuild America. And that's why I bring you this show. To tell you what's going on in America, to remind you of who we are as Americans. That's why I write my books, particularly the historical fiction. I mean, it's all about the story of us. It's the story of America. It just happens to be set in the West. The story of American values and American spirit and American ingenuity and freedoms and American exceptionalism and the perceptions of many men and women of uncommon cultures and differing origins and how they wove together into the cloth of the country. It's the story of us. And that's why I bring you some of this information which people just don't put together for you. I guarantee you there isn't another show that is talked about in one sitting, so you can connect, you have all the dots and you can connect them, and then you can compare them to an almost identical situation but having to do with mortgages just 6 years ago. I can almost guarantee you there's not another show on the air that has done that for you. But you know, there's a saying on the ranch, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink. I'm going to wind up this show. Wow, you might even be on time here. We're 56:08. I can tell by the way she's kind of jumping from one foot to the other. My producer is nervous. Don't worry, we'll make it. We'll make it. We won't get kicked off the air for being late. Okay, this is from the American Thinker article. Middle America is awakening from its 50-year coma. The only thing missing is a leader who will bluntly point out the obvious, who can understand and channel the pent-up rage, fear, and frustration that we are feeling after 50 years of being insulted, stolen from, and now physically threatened. Up until now, by their control of all the media, the left has made us feel that we were isolated and alone. The new media is changing that. It is one of the ironies of history that Mr. Facebook, Mr. Google, and Mr. Twitter and several others have created the instrument of their own destruction. You can apply Lenin's statement in reverse. They will sell you the rope that you will hang them with to describe their plight. Enter Donald Trump. Individuals have and always will change the course of things unpredictably and suddenly. Trump has consciously or unconsciously punched our red button. Trump is real and he is a motive. Wonkish analysis and reasoned debate do not fuel mass movements. Emotion does. Mass movements are like periodic fires that tear through an old, rotting, bug-infested forest and start a new cycle of vitality. The country is too far gone to resurrect it any other way. It is time to awaken the sleeping giant and let the chips fall where they will. Trump has tossed the match into the powder keg. The genie is out of the bottle now, and even if Trump falters, there will be another to take his place. He or she will have to be irrevocably committed to turning this country inside out and not be squeamish about how it is done, starting at the school board and ending at the White House. If he or she ever utters the word compassion, it will be all over. We are so sick of that word, it makes us want to throw up when we hear it. He or she had better not ever apologize for anything, anytime, anyhow. We don't care about anyone's personal foibles. We have to win and don't particularly care how it's done. And there's another little matter of holding accountable those who have inflicted this damage on us. They cannot be allowed to walk. The American Republic is in its end game. Let the game begin. Powerful, powerful article. And I did not get to tell you too much. I have a minute left. So the county convention and caucus was fascinating. And the Trump supporters, including myself, got railroaded because, and I don't think intentionally, but that's the way it worked out. The two national delegates were elected from the county first. The way Wyoming does it, there are 12 delegates selected in the county caucuses, and then another 14, a total of 29, there's three from the state party apparatus, a total of 29 that go to the national convention. Well, we're all kind of sitting there fat, dumb, and happy. And by the way, to tell you about the participation, 4 years ago there were 23 people at this caucus, and this year there were 75. How's that for people being stirred up? I mean, that kind of tells you what's happening all over the country. Anyway, the two national delegates stood up. Or actually, they were, first of all, they were elected. One guy got like 38, one guy got like 35, and then they stood up and they told us who they were for. Well, lo and behold, the guy who won was for Cruz, and the guy who came in second was for Rubio. And all us poor Trump people, we didn't even realize that we could have nominated one of us and at least had a run at the mill. Now, when they did the straw poll, just to see how everybody broke down, it came out quite interestingly different than what I expected and different than what I told you the week before. But it came out, and I'm going to round numbers here for you. It came out about 5% for Rubio and others. It came out about 17-18% for Trump, and it came and the rest went for Cruz, which surprised me. The bottom line is I jumped up, asked for the nominations to be reopened. I'm not going to give you all the stuff that went on. The Trump people kind of rallied around one another, and in the end, we got ourselves three or four delegates of the 12 that the county is sending to state convention, and I'm an alternate delegate. So the Trump people managed to do slightly better in the percentage of delegates being sent to state, which will select the next 14 delegates from the state caucus, than they did selecting the two national delegates, which we totally failed at. totally failed at the county caucus. Anyway, I don't have any more time to go into it today, or I'm going to be cut off by the AM. But it really was fascinating, and hopefully I'll have some time next week to tell you more about it. I met a lot of great people. I will tell you that the volunteers who run the Republican Party here in the county worked their butts off. I mean, there was all sorts. They had everything printed out. We had a three-hour discussion on platform and planks and change. It was very instructive, and it was grassroots. It was absolutely the bottom of democracy. Not, and I don't mean the bottom bad. I mean the very base, the very foundation of a representative republic. It was fascinating to watch, and I was proud when I left there. Forget how the voting came out. I was proud to see the republic work. And a lot of great people expressed their views very respectfully, but, you know, without backing down. It was a tremendous experience, and I'm so glad I went. And I'm looking forward to the state convention, which will be another learning experience, which is April 16th. In any event, this is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side. Watch your top knot and watch your wallet. We'll talk to you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.